From the Sky News Centre at 1, Islamic State has claimed responsibility for a series of terror attacks in Paris which have left more than 120 people dead. Nearly 100 others are critically injured. There'll be 3 days of mourning for the victims in France. Matt Steele reports.
What happened yesterday was an act of war.
France's president vowing to be merciless towards Islamic State today as he addressed the nation on TV. And it's a nation shaken by 6 attacks across its capital. The deadliest was at a music concert where audience members were taken hostage.
We were asking ourselves whether the bullets were real or not. And then he fired at someone, and I understood.
Dozens died there when the gunmen blew themselves up. Coordinated bombs also went off outside the National Football Stadium, and there were also shootings at busy bars and restaurants.
I arrived at the scene, and there were lots of dead bodies on the ground. Lots of dead bodies.
There is defiance in France. Football fans proudly singing the national anthem last night, and there are long queues of people wanting to give blood.
I wanted to be present here today to show my solidarity.
But sporting fixtures in Paris are all off today, and schools there, which normally open on Saturdays, are staying firmly closed.
David Cameron's warned we must be prepared for British casualties from last night's attacks. The Prime Minister's condemned those responsible as brutal and callous murderers.
Today, the British and French people stand together, as we have so often before in our history, when confronted by evil. Shocked, but resolute. In sorrow, but unbowed.
He says the UK terror threat level will remain at severe, although security will be tightened at ports and airports as well as theatres and other events. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers.
Menavan Prague.
This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is Susan Grossi. We've also got interviews with children's author and illustrator Elise Dolan, and you talk to the lovely
Nicola Upson.
Nicola Upson, local crime writer and of this parish of 105 as well. She does a show with Mandy Morton. So Susan writes crime. Crime novels with financial crime at their heart. And Susan, in your day job, you are an anti-money laundering consultant. I had to read that out because they're not words that I often use. So explain yourself. What is an anti-money laundering consultant?
Well, money laundering is how criminals try to break the link between the crime and the money that they've generated. If you make money from a crime and you then just try and spend it, people will spot that you're a criminal. So they have to go through all sorts of processes to try and clean up the money, which is why it's called money laundering. And I try and advise people on the regulated side of things, so banks, law firms and so on how to spot this criminal money and what they need to do when they have spotted it.
So you can spot it then?
You can, yes. I mean, it becomes more and more complex. The more sophisticated criminals use all sorts of very complicated procedures to try and launder their money. But there are things you can do, red flags, as they call it, that you can look out for, yes. It's mostly awareness, making people... I think you need to make people angry about money laundering. I think it's not right that criminals profit from their crimes.
And how did you get into this line of work?
Well, it's a bit of a strange career path, and I trained as a school teacher, so I was interested in training and education. And then through various redundancies and so on, I moved into the area of training adults in finance, and the area of it that really fascinated me was money laundering. And it, as with so many things, I just sort of fell into it, and that was, heavens, 23 years ago now.
Gosh, isn't that amazing? You wouldn't imagine it's something you'd just fall into.
You're right, Manny. You're right. But you are one of the good guys then.
I hope so, yes. I certainly feel very strongly about it. I think it's an important thing that people should be aware of, that criminals are out there trying to contaminate our financial system with their revolting, ill-gotten gains.
Oh, right. Oh, yes. You're definitely one of the good guys. Okay, well, we're going to come back and give you a proper introduction in just a moment. We're going to listen to your first choice of music now. This was lovely to hear again. This is the London Symphony Orchestra and the theme to Upstairs, Downstairs. Why have you chosen this?
Well, when I watched Upstairs Downstairs with my mother when I was a child, the first time, the original series, of course, it was the first time I think I'd realised that you could take a historical period and make up a story set in an historical period. And I thought that was a fascinating thing to do. So as long as you're true to history, you can put other things into it.
OK, well, lots of memories. The Bellamy family, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
Thank you.
London Symphony Orchestra, the theme tune to Upstairs, Downstairs, bringing back lots of memories there. And the first choice of music of our studio guest today on Bookmark, Susan Grossi. Susan, as we've heard, has worked as an anti-money laundering consultant since 1998. She's also written three crime novels, Fatal Forgery, The Man in the Canary Waistcoat and Worm in the Blossom, are all set in the Regency period. Each features police constable Sam Plank and has financial crime at its heart. Well, Susan, we've already heard how financial crime is a kind of passion of yours, or fighting crime, financial crime. At what stage did you think, actually, I can write fiction about this?
Well, like many people who studied English at university and are readers, I've often thought I'd like to write a book one day. But I'm not terribly good at thinking of plots out of nowhere. And I stumbled on the first one, Fatal Forgery, by accident. I was doing some research into a bank that had collapsed, and I was looking back through its history, because banks are often taken over by other banks, and so it's quite complex. And as I was reading around the story, I came across just a little side story, really, of a banker who had defrauded his own bank, a man called Henry Fauntleroy, who defrauded his own bank. And I was curious as to why he would take such a risk, because in the time that he did it, which was 1824, forgery, which he indulged in, was a capital offence. You went to the scaffold for it. Mm. And I thought, to take a respectable, more than respectable, he was a very well-trusted and well-liked man, why he would take such a risk. I was curious about that, so that was the start of it, and I started reading about him. And because of realising that you can take stories that are in history and adapt them for fiction, I thought perhaps he would be the start of something, and that was really the start of Fatal Forgery. It went through many iterations, but that was the start of it.
And I suppose by setting it in the Regency period, the stakes are higher, as you say, because the scaffold is always in the background.
That's right. Many, many crimes led to the scaffold. In fact, very few crimes didn't lead to the scaffold or to Australia, so one or the other. But it was astonishing that he would admit what he'd done, and I was curious as to A, why he'd done it, and B, why he would admit to it. So,
well, yes, you describe your books as why done it rather than who done it, and certainly in the case of that novel, we know very clearly at the beginning,
absolutely,
what he's done. That the book is about exploring why and the motivations for that.
Yes.
So in a sense it's different to a crime novel, in the sense that you know it's the other way around. You're trying to find out who did it rather than why.
Yes, absolutely. I'm always focusing on the why of it, because I think this is quite important in financial crime. I am curious as to why people do this. I think it's different from things like murder. You can often see with murder that there's a hatred there, or a jealousy or something like that. But financial crime, which of course is still so prevalent today, I want to know why people think it is, at the very heart of it, all right to take other people's things. I'm curious about that.
So the characters are quite different then, in a way. You know, a character who will murder somebody is going to be very different than a character who will steal money from a bank.
I think so, and often you find with people who've indulged in financial crime is that they will say things. I mean, I'm thinking of modern cases. They'll stand up in court and say, but I'm not a real criminal. And I'm curious about why they would do that, why they think this doesn't really count. Because, of course, hurting someone financially, obviously it's not as final and fatal as murdering them. But if you take away all of someone's money or all of their possessions, or you take away their good name, that can be fairly devastating for someone.
But setting it in the Regency period, so we're looking at the 19th century, did you find that then you've got to explain a financial system, though, to your readers?
Yes, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, the time when Henry Fauntleroy lived sort of set it, but I loved the idea of setting things in the Regency period, because people know a lot about the Georgian period, which is Jane Austen, basically, and they know a lot about the Victorian period, which is Dickens. But in between, there's about 15, 20 years where there's not a lot that is written about that period. And from a policing and a financial crime point of view, it's a period of great development. But what I found interesting, particularly between Fatal Forgery and the modern day, is the fact that what allows Fatal Forgery to happen is that this banker is taking share certificates, which at the time were brand new and people didn't trust them. They didn't know what they meant, because you used to have all of your money in gold and coin. And suddenly you gave that to your bank and they gave you a piece of paper. And this was what he managed to make his money out of. This is how he managed to exploit the system, people's uncertainty about whether a share certificate meant anything. So now you fast forward to the current day, and what are we worried about? We're worried about e-banking. We're worried about Bitcoin. We're worried about doing our banking online. We're not sure whether we can trust the new arrangements. And it's the same. It's exactly the same uncertainty.
Are you trying to make that point?
I didn't start out that way, but as I read it, and as I was writing and as I read back over it, I thought the emotions are the same. We learn nothing as human beings. There are still the greedy ones. There are still the ones who are naive and think you can make money out of nothing. There are still the ones who'll believe any story they're told. And there are still the ones who'll stand up in court and say, I'm not a real criminal. This happens now, and it happened back in 1820s.
Although I think now people are more likely to point fingers at bankers and call them criminals. Have you found that the public attitude towards people who work in the financial sector has changed?
I think so. I think there's less respect, perhaps because of education, because of things like the internet and so on. People do understand the financial sector more, and they think that these people aren't the only custodians of financial knowledge anymore. You can learn a little bit more now. And of course, in Fauntleroy's day, the man in the street knew nothing about how banks worked.
But Fauntleroy, in your novel, he's quite likeable.
Yes, and I wanted to make that point because, of course, in order to be a successful financial criminal, in order to be a successful fraudster to dupe people, you do have to be likeable. If you're horrid, no one will trust you.
Yes, it brings to mind all those Hollywood movies that whose plots I find very complex but always have a charming man at their centre.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, you do need it to be seductive. I suppose almost like a murderer in a way. You know, you need to fool the
yes.
reader, even though we know that he did it, you still need to give us some sort of ambivalence.
Yes, I needed to give him a justification for what he did, and I hope I achieved that. I mean, I won't say what it is in case people, you know, want to go and read and learn, but there are things that happened in his background that turned him into the man he is. That for all of us, we're all turned into who we are from what happened before.
So did you find yourself having sympathy for him?
I did to a certain extent. And indeed, the first time I wrote the book, it wasn't called Fatal Forgery. I called it A Fraudster and a Gentleman, because I felt that that was him. And it was only after I'd written it and read back through it, I thought, actually, I prefer the policeman. I like the policeman better. Although I liked Henry and I had made him sympathetic, I hope, I preferred the policeman. And so I rewrote it from the policeman's point of view.
Wow, you completely rewrote it.
I did, yes. The first book took me 4 years to write.
Wow.
And then you rewrote impressive. It.
Wow, that is impressive. Well, we're going to come back to you, Susan. So much to talk about. We're going to talk about plotting, and we'll speak to you about your police constable, your very charming police constable. But speaking of crime novels and crime novelists, you were lucky enough to chat with the lovely Nicola Upson.
I was. Nicola Upson worked in theatre and as a freelance journalist and is the author of two non-fiction works and the recipient of an Escalator Award from the Arts Council England. Her debut novel, An Expert in Murder, was the first in her series of crime novels to feature Josephine Tay, one of the leading authors of Britain's Age of Crime writing. Her sixth in the series, London Rain, is out now. When I met Nicola, I began by telling her how much I enjoyed the book, despite not being a fan of crime.
It's funny, lots of people say that to me, actually, because they don't necessarily read a lot of crime fiction, but what interests them maybe about these books are either the settings or the characters, because I think they are very much character-based books. And when I'm starting each one, the ongoing lives of the series characters, who I've come to care about a great deal, obviously, and luckily the readers have too, they're just as important to me as working out the logistics and the plot of the individual crimes in the books.
That's right, yes. The characters come across very strongly and you do really feel like you know them.
I'm pleased, and I think that takes a while. That's one of the luxuries, I think, of having a series to work with, is that you can build the pace and maybe, you know, some of the things that you come out with in the first book, perhaps a bit later on, you wish you hadn't, so you could tweak them slightly. But I think when you spend that time with the characters, you do get to know them and you can put them in different situations. And particularly, I think, with this one, because Josephine Tay obviously is a real person. All the books start with something real about her life or her work and then spin off from there. In this case, it's a play of hers called Queen of Scots and the fact that she genuinely did love London and spend a lot of time there.
And you have the coronation, 1937.
Yeah, do you know, it's really funny how that came about, because I knew when I started the book that I wanted to make Broadcasting House and the BBC a character in it. And I also knew that I wanted to feature a man called Val Gielgud, who was John Gielgud's older brother. And everything that John Gielgud was to the stage, Val Gielgud was to radio drama. But he also started at the BBC by working for the Radio Times. He used to make up letters for the letters page.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. Because he was such an interesting character, and because I've always loved the Radio Times. I grew up with it. So I went on the internet and ordered a Radio Times from 1937, because I knew I wanted to set the book in that year. And just as a matter of chance, the issue that I happened to get was the Coronation Supplement from May 1937. And I had it because I was attracted to this wonderful Richard Nevinson cover. And when I got that, issue, and I looked through it, and I looked at all the celebratory programmes they were having, and it had wonderful sort of golden age type crime things that you could use for clues, like maps of the coronation procession and cast lists. But more importantly, it said what the BBC was doing for the coronation. It was the first time that that esoteric service had been broadcast to the nation and to the empire. So I just knew from that moment on, from opening that Radio Times, that the book was going to be cemented over in that coronation week in May 1937.
And one of the things I love about your books is that you feel it so vividly. The way, you know, I feel as though I've slipped into 1937 and I'm living there and I'm looking at all of these incredible things. So you must do an incredible amount of research.
It's one of the loveliest parts of the book, I think, researching it, because it's always easier reading other people's books than writing your own. You know that. A lot of this book, as I said, was taken from the Radio Times and from the BBC at the time, and the BBC annual yearbooks and all that kind of stuff. But it's also, there's no substitute for going to the places themselves and walking the streets of London, because Broadcasting House, although it's got that new, huge, great, shiny addition now, that central Broadcasting House, which is that iconic building with the Eric Gill statue, it was the most amazing place. It was a world in itself, really. I think Josephine, at one point in the book, describes it as like a scene from the film Metropolis, because it's its own busy world. And I remember reading about that and finding so many things that were so interesting about the BBC at that time. The innocence, I think, of that age. I wanted to capture that. It's the sort of time where people turned up at 6 o'clock in the morning and spent 2 hours polishing the steps and filling all the inkwells. And there was a queue of 3,000 women, a waiting list of 3,000 women to be a charwoman at the BBC in the 1930s.
Oh my goodness.
And the engineers would go round and test all the record decks with the Teddy Bears Picnic, because it was the gramophone record that used the widest range of instruments.
And I was reading that you interviewed Sir John Gielgud.
I did. It was a lovely story. The book started out as my wanting to write a biography of Josephine Tay. And I wrote to John Gielgud, and I didn't expect to hear anything back, because I knew at the time of her death in the 1950s, he'd refused to cooperate with a lot of biographies, because he just felt, and lots of her close friends felt, that wasn't something she wanted. And so I got back to my flat in Cambridge, and my flatmate said, "Oh, John Gielgud's just phoned. You missed him."
Oh, my goodness.
I know. The amazing thing was that he rang back. I didn't ever meet him, but we had two wonderfully long, warm, frank telephone conversations where he talked about Josephine Tay in the theatre of the 1930s, or his friend Gordon, as he knew her, because she had several different pseudonyms.
And you mentioned a few times Noel Coward. Are you a fan as well?
I'm a huge fan of Noel Coward, yeah. Noel and Gertie had a cameo role in Two for Sorrow, which was set at the Cowdery Club, which was Josephine Tay's private club. It was a club for nurses and professional women in Cavendish Square. And it was the most extraordinary place. It was linked to the Royal College of Nursing. But Noel Coward's, I think it was his auntie, was genuinely connected to the Cowdery Club. So it's little kind of coincidences like that open up those holes for me to include people's work, whose work I admire, and people who were so important to the character of that period, if you like, in the books.
There was a reference in the book, in London Rain, that they went to see the play Private Lives.
Yes.
And then you mentioned Vile Bodies. And it's lovely because you're just mentioning them now and then, and it gives this flavour. But is it your favourite time period in history?
I think it's a fascinating period in history. Certainly it's the period that interests me most. Would I have liked to have lived through it? That depends on who I was, because one of the interesting things about the 1930s, the late 20s and early 30s, is what a contrast there was between, you know, the glamorous world of the West End and theatre and cinema, which is obviously the world that lots of my characters move in. But also, I've in Two for Sorrow explored kind of at the underbelly of London, the people who were a different cast completely. Contrasts are great for a novelist. I'm sure you find that in your book. That was interesting. The other thing that I think is why it chimes with me is I think that those interwar years were the single most important, perhaps, period of time for change for women. The First World War was still casting its shadow, even towards the late 1930s. And again, that had very mixed results, because obviously there was the huge loss and the national sense of mourning for all those men. But for some women, that was a very liberating thing. It gave them opportunities that they never would have otherwise had. And I think Josephine Tay herself was very much in that bracket. She was one of those women.
And do you think that you will write the biography?
Well, certainly not while I'm writing these books, because she's alive for me now as a character. people. The wonderful thing about these is I can always be on her side. I can always fight her corner. Because there were some things about her personality that I find harder. She could be quite cold. She could be quite distant. And they're things that I can not necessarily include in the books. Or if I do, I can show reasons why that might have been the case. So to write a biography, I think I would find quite restrictive now. And the lovely thing about these is that I never have to say goodbye to her when I put a book down, because luckily enough, so far, I've always known there's another book to come.
And you said that you're working on a standalone novel.
I am. Yeah, it's set a little bit earlier. It's set late 20s, early 1930s. And it's quite different for me because it's not a crime novel. Because the book started as books about Josephine Tay's life, and this book that I'm writing now is also a reimagining of a real life. It feels very intimately connected, really. It doesn't feel like a departure just because it doesn't have a murder and it doesn't have, I say it doesn't have a plot, of course it has a plot, but it's the plot of someone's life. And it is very different from the writing point of view, because I don't think until I moved away from the crime genre briefly that I ever really understood how important structurally those murders and the crimes were to the momentum of the book and how they carry the book forward. I'm having to find different ways to structure this particular novel, which is very challenging and a great deal of fun. And I think I love the opportunity to do something a bit different. I think I should go back refreshed to the series, having stepped away from them a bit. The danger of a series is that it will become a bit formulaic, and I never want those characters to do the same things. I want their lives always to be kind of fresh and interesting, so it's nice to be away from them a bit so I can go back perhaps a bit more detached.
Do you miss them like friends?
Do you know, when I've finished a book, I'm usually so pleased actually just to put them back in the box for a bit, because it is a bit obsessive. So when it gets to the stage where the books come out and I'm happy to talk about them again, it's actually nice to see them again, yeah, and I will be pleased to get back to them.
So when can we expect the next in the series?
Well, it's got to be finished by the end of next April, I think. Next April or May, so I've got some work to go on that. Roughly, I've got some ideas for it, but it's not very fully formed yet. I can't think about that until I finish this standalone. So it'll probably be, you know, somewhere early 2017 it'll come out.
And the standalone will be out?
Yeah, hopefully sometime next year. I mean, I don't know yet, because it's wonderful, because I haven't got a contract for that. It's funded by the Arts Council, which is wonderful. They gave me a research grant. But it's a bit like writing my first book again, because there's no contract, there's no promises to anybody, there's no delivery deadlines. So in a way, that's bad for me, because I work better to a deadline. But in a way, it's also very liberating, because there are no expectations other than the expectations I have to make it the book that I wanted to write.
That's Nicola Epson there talking to Mena about her latest book, London Rain. And you can hear Nicola on the Eclectic Lights show, which goes out one Sunday in the month. You can find out which Sunday that is if you go to the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.fm. And she also pops up on Nicola's mid-morning show, which is on a Tuesday between 10 and 1. We've got Susan Grossi, who's our studio guest, also a crime novelist. Nicola was talking there about both the luxury and the danger of writing a series. Did you empathise with that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I didn't start out wanting to do a series. I thought that Fatal Forgery would be, as she calls it, a standalone. I didn't really think about going any further. But when I finished it, I felt bereft. I'd fallen in love, I suppose, with Sam Plank, with my police constable. And so I moped around a little bit, and then one day my husband, who'd put up with this other man in my life for so long, said, oh, for goodness sake, just go and write another one. And because Fatal Forgery sort of brackets Plank's life, I don't want to give too much away in the plot, but it's set mostly in 1824, but it does then leap forward to 1830. I thought, well, that's a very good bracketing device, because what I could do is I could fill in those years. And I realised if I set a book in each year in those years, I could do a series of seven, and that rather pleases me. It's a nice number, and it'll take Plank through, I think, to retirement. People didn't live as long then. 1829 is when the Met Police started, so he'll join the Met Police for a year, pass on some of his wisdom, and then, I think, retire.
And she talked also about the innocence of the age. She was talking not as far back as you. Do you feel the innocence of the Regency period? I mean, this is quite bawdy as well, isn't it?
It is quite bawdy, yes. And I never thought of it as a particularly innocent age. I thought there was a lot of facing up to some of life's more unpleasant details. I mean, Sam is married and he and his wife have no children, and we explore why that is. And you get the idea of a little woman sitting at home and just sort of waiting for the husband. But Martha has seen some of the pretty harsh sides of life. She took over her as mother of her family when her mother died when she was very young. Her father was a drunkard. Sam saved her from that situation. And I think people were very aware of things. And even there are some protected characters. One of the magistrate has a daughter who is perhaps one of the more protected characters in it, in that she's a young woman in society. And so she's not exposed so much to the terrible parts of life. But I think most of the other characters see it for what it is.
And I suppose writing about women in that period, you do have to be aware of the mores of the time and what they were allowed to do.
Yes, oh, definitely. I think it would be a mistake to sort of put someone in there with feminist thoughts that would have, you know, been a century too early. I think there's an equality in Sam and Martha's marriage, which is unusual, but not strangely unusual. I think it's welcome, and it's a warm equality. But she wouldn't for one second think of making decisions that are his to make. And I think it would be a mistake to give people modern thoughts in a historical period.
Although she's great, Martha. I really liked her.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah,
yes.
Very feisty and very independent.
Yes, a lot of the feedback I got after Fatal Forgery was saying, please, can we have more Martha? So in the second and the third, I've tried to give more Martha.
Do you find yourself doing also a lot of research, as Nicola was saying?
Oh, huge amounts. And as she says, it's one of the more enjoyable things. I tend to lock myself away in the university library. I go and hide away in the chemistry department, because if I go to somewhere else, I'll be tempted to read all the books in that department. I'm not very interested in chemistry, so it's a very safe place for me to hide. And I take my little history books with me and just sit there and read and read and read. And as Nicola said again, walking in London, I do a huge amount of walking in London. Every route that Sam walks, I walk to make sure I've got the timings correct, because I don't want him doing a journey in the wrong timings. He walked everywhere, of course. And if you look above street level in London, you will see Sam's London. The street level has changed. There are all the signs and the shops and the hoardings and so on. But you look above that, it's Sam's London. It's astonishing.
Well, talking about nostalgia, your next choice of music, very nostalgic, beautiful voice of Doris Day, Que Sera Sera. Why have you chosen this?
Well, my mother, who died when I was a little girl, was a great fan of Doris Day and used to sing. She had a reasonable voice. I have a terrible voice, but she had a reasonable one. And she was an unthinking feminist, I would say, my mother. She just assumed that you could do anything you wanted in life. She didn't ever make a point of that. She just assumed it was the case. She was a working woman. I'm a working woman. It was just expected. And I thought this song sums up a lot of that attitude. It will just happen for you.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be, when I grew up and fell in love, I asked my sweetheart what lies ahead. Will we have rainbows day after day? Here's what my sweetheart said. Que sera, sera. Que sera, sera. What will be. Now I have children of my own. They ask their mother, what will I be? Will I be handsome? Will I be rich? I tell them tenderly. Que sera, sera. Será, será. What will be, que será, será.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105, and our studio guest today is crime writer Susan Grossi. Susan, you've got, what fabulous glasses, I must say. I was ashamed this is radio. I just looked up at you. They are sort of diamante glasses. I'm a bit Dame Edna, if I might say so.
They are indeed. I think if you've got to wear reading glasses, you might as well just go for it.
Just go for it, indeed. Oh, I'm sorry, we should have a webcam in here. But you're going to read an extract of your work for us now.
I am indeed. This is from the third in the Sam Plank series called Worm in the Blossom. And so it was that Wilson and I found ourselves ambling along in a cab, the Jarvie under careful instructions to keep his distance from our quarry. If either of us had anticipated a breakneck chase through the park, we were disappointed, as I doubt that a funeral procession had ever moved at a more stately pace. It was clear that whatever his destination, Edward Brigstock was reluctant to reach it. After nearly an hour, Brigstock finally dismounted and tied his horse to the railings outside a coffee house. We were in Blackfriars, not far north of Waterloo Bridge, and within sight of the tiered steeple of St Clement Danes. Wilson and I climbed down from the cab and I walked round to pay the Jarvie. "Your man's a lawyer, then," he said, as he carefully counted out change into my palm. "A lawyer?" I asked. "What makes you say that?" "Searles." He jerked his chin towards the coffee house. "Popular with young barristers intent on making their name. Fond of the sound of their own voices, that lot." I could well imagine. He clicked his tongue at his horses and moved off, and Wilson and I paused outside the coffee house. The entrance was flanked by two massive doorposts in a classical design, and even as we made to enter, a group of three young men came barrelling round the corner of Portugal Street and pushed past us into Searles. "After you, gentlemen," said Wilson, and caught the closing door to hold it for me. Given the hour, too late for lunch, too early for supper, Searles was still remarkably busy, but I suppose that lawyers would call in for refreshment on their way to and from court at all hours. The wood-panelled room was divided by high back benches into booths, with room for up to six men in each, while cutlery, salt cellars and the like were kept on a table in the middle. Portraits of various severe-looking fellows, distinguished lawyers at a guess, looked down over the crowd, and a large clock on one wall reminded us all of pressing engagements elsewhere. Wilson touched my elbow and indicated the booth furthest from the entrance, where Edward Brigstock was now sitting with a tankard in front of him. One of the three men who'd arrived just before us went up to him, I assumed, to ask if they could share his booth, and Brigstock waved him away, looking past him towards the door. Wilson and I slid into another booth, whose only occupant was a dusty-looking fellow of advanced years who barely glanced up from his paper, but acknowledged our arrival with a grunt. A potboy came over and we ordered two ales. When our tankards arrived, Wilson lifted his with alacrity, but I shook my head. "We don't know how long we'll be here," I said quietly, trying not to draw the interest of our companion. "If you drink at that rate, and we're here for a couple of hours, it'll be me looking out for whoever and you under the table." "Aye, I can see that," said Wilson, and took the smallest bird-like sip of ale. Just then, a slight man with pale eyes and reddish hair came into the coffee house and looked around before spotting Brigstock, walking over to him and slipping into the booth opposite him. As they talked, Brigstock's face darkened. I kicked Wilson lightly under the table. Just then, Brigstock stood abruptly. "You'll come to regret that, sir," he said to his companion, the menace apparent in his tone. He drained his tankard, slammed it onto the table and left the coffee house. The man left behind sat for a moment, thoughtfully tugging on his earlobe before walking out past us. He did not look menaced or even slightly perturbed by his encounter. As I put it to Mr. Conant when I saw him that evening to add to his store of information on Edward Brigstock, I had a feeling that our gentleman was meddling in affairs of which he had little experience.
Thank you, Susan. That's told in the voice of Sam Plank.
It is indeed.
So where did Sam come from?
Well, he was the character in the first one, in Fatal Forgery. He was the policeman. I needed someone to chase the banker, and so I made up a magistrate's constable. The police force didn't exist at that point, and so what happened was, if you thought that you'd had a crime committed against you, go and report the matter to your local magistrate, and if he agreed with you, he would issue a warrant for arrest, and his constable would go and serve the warrant. So magistrates, constables existed to bring criminals into the criminal justice system. So I created one of these, and as I was reading through some trial transcripts from the Old Bailey, which I spent a lot of my time reading, I came across the name Sam Plank, and I thought, what a fantastic English name that is. It's solid, it's determined, and so I made him Constable Sam Plank. And that was really where he started, and he's going to go through all seven. It's going to be in his voice. The books are written, I hope sharp chapters. I date them as in a police notebook, and I try and keep it crisp in a police style, so there's not too much flowery description, because that's not what a policeman would care about. He wants to know, who is it, what's he doing, how am I going to get him?
It does strike me when you say that there was no police force at that time and you're talking about the process with the magistrates. You set yourself quite a hard task by writing a crime novel in that period.
Yes.
Because there's... You have to research everything, because although it's not within living memory, you know and I know that there are Regency scholars out there who will be on your back if you get the slightest thing wrong.
Absolutely. But then I like the challenge of it. I like the puzzle of it. I like learning about something that's not familiar. And I think that partly what attracted me to the Regency period is that we are in this transition. The thing everyone has heard of is the Bow Street Runners. Everyone's heard of them, but they are pre this. So they're pre the magistrates, constables. And I like the fact there is this sort of interim period, an interregnum almost, in the police when they were deciding for a growing metropolis like London, which it was growing like Topsy, how are we going to control this population? We can't rely on neighbourhoods looking out for each other anymore. And they went through this magistrates' council, and then finally they said, we've got to centralise it. And that was when the Met happened in 1829.
And I suppose there's still the same sense of right and wrong. You know, morals haven't changed that much.
No, morals haven't changed, certainly. There's still the same feeling that you should be able to get redress for an ill that is done against you. There's still that feeling. It was the punishments that were almost unrecognisable. I mean, for instance, if you fell into debt, and I do have some debtors in Man in the Canary Waistcoat, you would be thrown into debtor's prison, which meant you couldn't work, and therefore you couldn't pay off your debt. So it was a very strange thing. Of course, this happened to Charles Dickens' father. He was thrown into the Marshalsea. And one, you're in prison, you can't earn, so you can't pay off your debt. So you can never get out of debtor's prison. It's a crazy setup, which, of course, we have resolved to a certain extent now, but it existed for many, many years.
Well, we've come this far without mentioning Dickens, which is pretty good. Do you use him as a source of research?
Can I make a terrible confession?
Go on. Yeah, nobody's listening. It's all right. It's just us.
I've never read any Dickens.
Right.
I've watched lots of Dickens, but I've never read any. I read English at university, and I managed to do that without reading any Dickens.
Wow.
It's horrifying, isn't it?
I was told off by my father the other day, who dedicated the whole of last year to reading every single work of Dickens. And then I said, oh, yeah, I'm reading some Dickens too, but I was actually listening to them on audiobooks, and he says that doesn't count.
Well, I agree, that doesn't count.
But it was very time-effective way of reading Dickens,
but
I
you
felt.
Could do that, Susan. You could listen to them on audio.
I could. While I'm writing, I make myself a strict rule that I can't go within a century of Sam. I cannot read or watch anything that is set within a century of the year I'm writing about. It is
harsh.
But I'm so easily confused, you see.
Makes sense.
At least you know your limits.
I do.
Okay, we're going to take a slight shift next, because we're going to speak to Elise Dolan. She's an author and illustrator of books for children. In 2013, she was shortlisted for the Roald Dahl Funny Prize, and last year she was nominated for the prestigious Kate Greenaway Medal and shortlisted for the Waterston Children's Book Prize. When I met her, I asked her how she came to be working in children's fiction.
Oh, well, I got into illustrating first, because that's something I actually set out to do. I originally did a fine art degree, where it was all very geared towards the, you know, pickling sharks and strip lights that flicker on and off. And I didn't really fit in there. So I decided after my degree I was going to go and do a master's, but I was going to do it in something much more sensible. I was going to do children's book illustration instead. It was at Cambridge School of Art, which is part of Anglia Ruskin. And that's where I learnt to illustrate children's books, but they also encouraged you to start writing your own stories as well. And I started doing it on that course, so I'm kind of an accidental writer.
And what was it about children's books that attracted you in particular?
Oh, well, the kids just seem to have a lot more fun, more than anything else. I mean, I wanted to just sort of work in a much more irreverent kind of way. And children's books allow you to do sort of fanciful, whimsical, stupid things, which, as an adult, you're not usually allowed to do.
And how would you describe your style? Do you have a particular style, or does it change depending on the book?
Oh, style's a bit of a difficult thing. I mean, I certainly work in a consistent way. It always looks like I did it. Style's kind of like handwriting. You can try and, you know, influence it one way or the other, make it neater, make it whatever. But in the end, you kind of get what you're given. And that's what I find with the way that I work. It just sort of came out after a while.
And does the style of the illustration reflect the story?
To an extent. I suppose in terms of what I decide to put where and exactly how loose and messy something looks could be used to illustrate something that looks a bit more chaotic. But, I mean, to be fair, I think I'm fairly consistent in the way that the work I make looks. in terms of the level of detail that I use, that varies from book to book. So I've illustrated things which I haven't written as well. I did a book called The Clockwork Dragon, which was written by Jonathan Emmett. I illustrated that in a slightly different way. I mean, the way that the use of line looks, and to an extent the way I've coloured it, I think that's quite familiar with the rest of my body of work. But maybe things like the character design and things is a little bit different, and that's to reflect that particular text.
And what medium do you prefer?
Oh, I use a variety of things. Usually I'll start with a sketch. I'll do what's called a rough of each particular double page spread. That's two pages that are facing each other. And then I'll use a light box and trace that with some particularly marvellous marker pens I've got at the moment, which are, they're not water soluble, so you can then watercolour over them, which is what I do to get the main body of the colour. And then usually I've made an awful lot of mistakes, so I'll scan it all into the computer and use Photoshop to tidy things up and then put all my drawings together to make a finished page.
And when you're starting a new book, do you start with the idea for the plot, or is it an illustration or an image that comes into your head? Which comes first?
I kind of start with a concept more than anything else. I'll decide that a book that's recently come out called The Mystery of the Haunted Farm, and the way that one started was I decided that I wanted to do something sort of spooky and Halloween-y, but I also wanted to do kind of a slightly satirical take on the traditional children's farm book, like here are the ducks, here are the pigs kind of thing. So I started off just with the concept of sort of the world that is a haunted farm, and started drawing what the place would look like, what kind of characters would live there, and it's from doing that kind of sketchbooking, that kind of idea, that stories just sort of grow up out of them.
That sounds great fun. And you must be aware that a lot of your books will be read by adults children. So do you put little things in the illustrations to keep the adults entertained?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I think the thing about picture books is that you often do have a dual audience. They're made to be read to someone by someone. And often the person doing the reading is a parent who may have had to read that book again and again and again and again, night after night after night, if it's a particular favourite. So I like to put in little jokes in the sides that'll entertain my adult audience as well as my child audience.
And they're very detailed, your pictures, so you do have the room and the style to do that.
Oh yeah, I do. I do a kind of book which is sort of known in the trade as a Wimmel book, which means a teeming, busy book. And one of the brilliant things about having that sort of level of detail in there, it means that you can put in these little subplots on the side. There's a space to do that, so you can go back to the book again and almost find an entirely new little story going on in the background.
And how long would it take you to illustrate something like that?
It's quite variable, depending on how smooth the project goes, really. I mean, the Mystery of the Haunted Farm, which I just mentioned, that took me, about 9 months to do. But that's because there were a few rewrites at the beginning of the story, and just to get it perfect. But I've just finished the book, which is a sort of a similarly detailed book, and I'm afraid I can't tell you anything about it at the moment, because it's incredibly top secret. That one took me about 5 months, which was a lot quicker. But that one was quite a rush. I mean, it's difficult to do a book that detailed in that small amount of time.
And when you're poring over a picture day after day or hour after hour, how easy is it for you to stay engaged with it?
Oh, well, that's part of the reason I put the little jokes and the sides for adults in there, to keep myself entertained and stop me from going insane. But it can be difficult, especially if you've been working on one particular image for a good few days. You start to lose perspective over it, so you can't tell whether you're creating genius or something that needs to go straight into the bin anymore. So that's why it's really helpful, if you've got other illustrator friends you can show something to, and they'll be like, yes, this is the best thing anyone's ever created, or you should burn it.
And what is the image that you've created that you're proudest of?
Oh, God, it's very hard to pick an individual one. I don't know how proud I feel about any of them half the time. I don't think I have one. I don't think I could pick any sort of one image.
What happens to the artwork after it's been published? Because these are beautiful works of art.
I've only started working in a sort of manner where I've actually got physical artwork for this latest book, because usually I do this sort of, it's a few different drawings which are then assembled together digitally. So those individual drawings, I've got them all sort of stashed away in boxes and folders and things around the house. I know a lot of people sell them in a gallery context, but it's not something I've ever done so far. So I've got, an entire wealth of drawings ready to be flogged.
And is this what you see yourself doing now for the foreseeable future, being a children's book illustrator and writer? It's a nice job.
Oh yeah, I can't see myself changing. This is kind of the dream job. This is the sort of my ultimate thing that I wanted to do. I mean, I've sort of combined it with other things. I also teach children's book illustration on the MA at Anglia Ruskin, and I'm also doing my PhD in children's books there as well, so I've got plenty of other things going on, but my primary job is writing and illustrating children's books, and I really wouldn't want that to change anytime soon.
And is there a particular children's book illustrator or a particular children's book, the illustrations in it, you admire?
Oh, well, I love Around the World with Mook by a French author and illustrator called Marc Boutefont. It's a really beautiful, detailed book, which is kind of like the way in which I work. He's definitely been a big influence on me.
And is it true you're named after a department store?
Oh, well, my dad, who named me, would say definitely not, but he happened to grow up down the road from a department store called Ely's in Wimbledon, which is the same spelling as my name. To be fair, all the evidence points towards it.
That's Elise Dolan there, a children's writer and illustrator. Our studio guest today on Bookmark is Susan Grossi. Susan, have you ever been tempted to write something modern, move away from the Regency period?
I don't think I have, no. I because the research is such an important part of it for me, I feel I'd lose that whole side of it, that sort of backstory that I enjoy so much. And setting something in the modern age, I wonder whether you're becoming a hostage to fortune, because you'll include technology that goes out of currency and so on, whereas at least you know what you're dealing with in a historical period. It's all set and finished, so you've got a finite set of information that you're working with.
So do you know where you might go after the seventh novel is finished?
Oh, no, I haven't thought about that at all. Funny, my husband asked that just the other day. He said, are you going to write more in the Regency period, do you think? So he obviously thinks I'm going to carry on writing. I thought seven was a nice sort of number to finish with. But he's obviously
his pension, I think.
I think maybe he is, yes. I think he quite likes that I'm tucked away in the library so he can watch the rugby and go cycling.
And financial crime, which is at the heart of your books, getting the emotion in that. Because when I have to say, when I picked up your crime novel, I thought, well, I'm going to learn a lot about financial crime, but am I going to feel moved by it? And I did. So getting the emotion in financial crime, you're looking at the effects that it has on people, presumably.
Very much.
On the perpetrator as well as the victim.
Yes, very much so, very much. And I've plotted all seven. I know what each is going to be about. So I've got a core financial crime at the heart of each. So we've got forgery for the first one. The second one, Man in the Canary Waistcoat, was investment fraud. And this third one, Worm in the Blossom, is bribery and corruption and extortion. And the next one is going to be art fraud. So I've got financial crimes at the centre of each of them. And yes, you're right, I'm looking at the effect it has on the people who are the victims. So in the Worm in the Blossom, for instance, there's a lot of family disaster because people are being bribed and their good name is being dragged through the mud through blackmail. The family gathers around them and tries to protect them, which of course makes it worse. Blackmailers love nothing more than lots of people getting involved who they can all blackmail. So the impact on that is terrible. And then on the people who are dragged in, who are connected with the criminals as well, the devastating effect it has on their lives too.
There's quite a big cast of characters in your books. Not confusingly big, but you do pull on quite a lot of people from different social strata as well.
Yes, I'm glad that seems to work, because I have got these people that I want to bring back again and again. I keep putting notes. I've got a big A4 book where I'm plotting them as I go, and I keep putting notes. Don't forget to mention this man again, or don't forget to bring back the canary, and things like this. So I want to have this sort of wave movement through the series to make sure that people are contributing as much as they possibly can to the stories.
And you mentioned Henry Fauntleroy, who
yes.
you based the first novel on.
Yes.
Do you go back to other real-life crimes for the other novels?
Less so. I haven't sort of followed someone through as I did with Henry, not to that extent, but I do spend a lot of time reading Old Bailey crime transcripts, and I get a lot of detail as to how crimes happened, and particularly how they were, and I use the word very advisedly, investigated. We didn't have investigators, but you'd have a constable turn up and say, well, I saw this and I saw that. And I get a lot of that detail from the Old Bailey transcripts. You get their way of describing things. So you'll say, and they won't just say, no, he was out of, they say he was out of house at an unreasonable hour. And you think, what a very police way to put it.
Nervous, yeah.
You know, so you make sure you mirror that, because that's how they thought of it. He wasn't indoors, he was out of house. So I try and make sure that I'm true to how people would have perceived things in those days.
That must be fascinating, reading those documents.
It is. Sometimes they're very fulsome, and other times very, very limited. Like, I wanted to include a sort of side storyline about homosexuality in this one, but it was very difficult to research, because although people were tried for homosexual crimes, they weren't reported because it was considered too shocking to report it. So you know it happened. You've got very bald statistics. This many men were found guilty, but you get no crime transcripts because you weren't allowed to write it down. It was too horrifying to write down.
And the death penalty applied then?
To certain things, yes. So, but it was more, it led into other crimes like blackmail, because what you do is you trap a man in the back of a Jarvie and in the back of a carriage, and you'd say that he approached you with a homosexual request. And, of course, there's no witness either way, and he's desperate to protect his name, and so he submits to the blackmail. So it was a very easy way to get people under your control.
What do your clients now? Because you, as we said at the beginning, you're working in the consultancy business, working with people in the financial sector now. What do they? I know they read your books. What do they think of them?
They think it's very interesting. They're not at all surprised because they know that I am basically an obsessive on this subject. So when they heard that I'm writing a novel, they all rolled their eyes and said, "It's about financial crime, isn't it?" So they knew that it was no surprise at all. But they're interested too because they are obsessives in their own way, the people I deal with, and they're interested in the history of what they're dealing with now. And they find it as fascinating as I do that we see the same things coming up again and again. People imagine that we've invented banking fraud and they imagine that we've invented forgery and so on. Of course, we haven't. It's been around for so long.
And you write non-fiction books on financial crime. Do you find there's a sort of symbiotic relationship between the two, that they help each other?
Not really, no. In the non-fiction books, I have to be very, very precise. There's no room for any imagining of any sort. So I'm just describing, this is the situation, this is the law you have to obey, this is what you must do. So I keep that very crisp and very tight. And, I mean, you have to sort of give little case studies. Oh, this is what a criminal could do if you allow it to happen. But I try and keep that as neat as possible in there.
And you blog as well. You have a lot of contact with writers. I know that they, with your readers, that they can get to you via your website. That's quite nice, isn't it?
It is, yes. Well, I do two blogs. I do a work blog called IHateMoneyLaundering.com, which is self-explanatory.
Yes, say what you see, yeah.
And then I do a writing blog, partly because I think being a writer is quite an isolating thing, and I wanted to have a way to talk. I mean, it's not real conversation, is it? But to talk to other people about the process. And then lots of other writers were contacting me and saying, oh, it's interesting how you've chosen to do this, that or the other. And so I started asking people's opinions. For instance, the readers of my blog chose the two titles of books 2 and 3. I didn't choose those. So the first one I chose, Fatal Forgery, but the other ones I would put out a shortlist of, I think these titles would work, which one do you like best? And they'd vote, and that was how the title The Man in the Canary Waistcoat and Worm in the Blossom, that's how they happened.
Gosh, wow. I haven't heard of that before.
Yes, well, I couldn't make up my mind, but also I wasn't sure, you know, if you get too close to something, you're not sure what's working anymore and what isn't, which title seems to carry the, I had to give a gist of the plot without giving the end of it away to people, say, well, this is the heart of it, do you think this title would work? And the ones they chose, booksellers have said to me they're very strong titles, so I'm pleased with that reaction.
Good. Well, thank you very much for coming into the studio, Susan. When you leave us here, what are you going to do? Do you write? How do you split your day between your consultancy and your writing?
Well, I used to try and split the day, and I can't do that because I really, in order to write, I find, for me to write historical, I have to dive back into it and I have to think about nothing else. So I dedicate a day to the writing. So Sunday tends to be my writing day for fiction. And then the rest of the time, I'm working on my day job because I work full time at that.
So you just write one day a week?
At the moment, in the run-up to it. So the books always come out in October. And so from November to June, I write one day a week. And then I have a 3 or 4 week strong writing period. I take holiday from work and I write every day during that time, heading up to the October publication date.
And I know that you're doing readings and you're going to be part of the Ely Literary Festival and you're reading toppings. What kind of questions do you get? Are people, they must be fascinated by the subject because it is a fascinating subject.
Yes, and this is what surprises me when I've had people say, oh no, financial crime won't sell. I think, my goodness, it's a hot topic at the moment. Everyone's interested. So people want to know, is Sam real? People are often interested in that. Is Sam real? Will Martha do more? They always want to know if Martha's going to be doing more. And I have to say, within restrictions, as we discussed earlier. And they want to know why I'm doing a series and why I put a constable at the beginning of it. So there are all sorts of things that people come up with.
Well, you can refer them to the Bookmark podcast.
I shall.
And if people want to find out more about you, you've got a website as well.
I have, yes, I have. So if they just look up my name, which is such an odd and peculiar name. I was named after the Queen's Corgi, by the way.
So oh, were you?
That poor woman named after a department store. She's got nothing on me, named after a dog. So
what, Susan?
Susan, yes. It was the Queen's favourite Corgi. Yes, it was her Corgi when she married. And my mother loved the name and stuck with it. So, so yes, but Grossi is such a strange. So if you just put Susan Grossi, that's Grossi to rhyme with Bossy, and I've lived with that for a long time, then you'll find me.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much. And if you want to be mentioned, the podcast there and the Cambridge 105 website, if you want to listen to any of the old bookmarks, then go to the Cambridge 105 website. That's cambridge105.fm. And they're all up there and you can download them. You can also listen to them via radio player. Our next show, we're on crime again, aren't we? We can't stay away from crime. Our studio guest is Emily Winslow-Stock. She's a Cambridge crime writer. We'll also have interviews with photographer and writer Tim Rawl and Alinka Rublak. We'll also be talking to her. But we'll play out now with, this is your last choice of music. This is from the film Amelie, and I'm going to try and say this. Your French might be better than mine. Je suis jamais allé, Jan Tiersen. Why yes. This one?
Well, when I write my historical fiction, I sometimes have music on in the background, but I can't have words, because if I'm trying to write words, I can't listen to words. So it has to be instrumental. And this is one of my favourites. So there's only one track on this whole album that has words. The rest of it is just beautiful instrumental, and I could listen to it forever.
Thank you, Susan.
City Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.